From road rage to personal attacks on social media, people are increasingly displaying their anger in public, and often it's getting out of control. For the rest of this hour, we're going to look at anger, its causes, and its consequences. Joining me in studio is Yvette Erasmus. She's a psychologist and consultant with expertise in nonviolent communication. Welcome, Yvette.
Hi, welcome.
And we're also joined by Rezma Menakem. He's the author of My Grandmother's Hands, Racialized Trauma and the Pathway to Mending Our Hearts and Bodies. Rezma, thanks so much for joining us
again. Thank you for having me.
And we'd also love to hear from you. If you've noticed more public displays of anger in your community, call us, share what you're seeing. Where are you seeing it? And how do you deal with your own anger? Have you had to manage it in the past? What worked for you? You can join us when you call with your question or comment at 651-227-6000, that's 651-227-6000, or toll free at 1-800-242-2828. Again, that's 1-800-242-2828. Yvette, how do you define anger?
Oh, that's such a lovely question. I would say that I think about anger as being a combination of two things that arise within us. Usually at its core, there's a deeply, chronically unmet need that is coming to our awareness. It can be for safety, it can be for equality, it can be for mattering. But then on top of the deeply unmet need, we layer a lot of judgmental thinking. And the kind of judgmental thinking that I think leads to anger in particular is externalized and is about what is wrong with the other person or the system or something outside of me. And so I see the other person or the behavior as something bad and wrong. And the degree to which I'm thinking through that frame, coupled with this deeply unmet need that is universal and human, we see a huge increase in anger. So it sort of builds on the fight response, and we move into advocacy energy. And also, unchecked or unskillfully used, it can be a lot of fight energy and a lot of aggression.
Based on that description, it seems... it makes it more understandable to me how hate and anger is linked with hate, and how unmet, anger in a person, the anger that's not dealt with can actually transform into hateful action.
Yeah.
Does that sound right, Rezma?
Yeah. One of the things that when I think about anger, I used to be I was the clinical director for Harriet Tubman Center. So I had developed an approach for working with both men and women who had committed acts of violence on their partner. And one of the things that I, to kind of expound on what Yvette said, one of the things that I found was that at its core, when you begin to peel back things for people, you find that there really is something fueling the anger. And a lot of times we go straight to the behavior without asking, well, what's fueling it? Not as an excuse, but if you can't get to what's fueling people's behavior or their reactions or their sensations or the meaning, if you can't get to that, it's really hard for people to begin to grapple with the anger because they don't even know where to begin to start. And so for me, anger really is about, yes, it's about unmet need, but it's also about, like you said, when we wrap into the when it goes unchecked and we begin to move into the hate thing, it's really about people's need to feel safe. And when they don't, they develop strategies to protect themselves from experiencing those things. And those strategies work. Anger works. That's why people use it. Right. So and what I mean by work, I don't mean that it works in terms of helping to develop a deepness between me and you. I mean, it works in terms of how it judges the distance between me and you. Right. Yeah. I can either bring you closer or push you away through anger, especially if I haven't developed other ways of managing that that energy.
Yeah. Yvette, how does anger show up in our bodies physically? What's the physical action that's happening when we get angry?
So your stress response system obviously perceives a threat. And so we can slow down right there and talk about all of the complexities with perception, which I'm sure Rezma can talk to a little bit more. But we perceive a threat, and so your fight-flight system kicks in. You know, your endocrine system kicks in, you have adrenaline coursing through your body, you have cortisol coursing through your body, you start trembling, your hands go cold, your vision narrows, because your system is preparing you to deal with a threat. And the degree to which you're able to feel that and track that, I mean, a lot of what you're bringing in around sensation, the more you're going to stay able to stay choiceful and conscious around it. And a lot of people in our culture don't have that awareness or that training. And so they have this felt sense experience. It doesn't happen consciously. And so they become fearful and reactive. And just going back to this idea of hate that you were bringing in, I think we convert anger into hate when we begin dehumanizing the other. So we have this fearful reaction, which we need to be learning to manage differently in our culture. But then we throw on top of it lots of ideas of wrongness of the other person, which increases our self-righteousness and our defendedness. I love what you're bringing in about self-protection. But then the degree to which we create an enemy of that other and we other them in some way and dehumanize them, that allows us to begin hate. And once we begin hate, we can begin killing.
So you were saying that you mentioned that anger works.
Right.
Are there benefits to being angry?
Absolutely. So if you just think about, like, if I said to you, think about the last time you were angry, your body would begin to immediately begin to respond to that. Like, you may not, you know, have this like burst of reaction, but your body would begin to kind of what I call remember what that was like. Your face might get flush, all these different types of things. And so when I said earlier about how anger can serve as a protective measure, that's one of the benefits, is that anger can if I've learned that to be vulnerable puts me in a position to where I can get hurt, anger can help motivate me, and that energy can help me maybe potentially thwart it, or dissociate from it. Right. And so one of the things that people begin to do is time can decontextualize anger and trauma. And so all it takes is the march of time, and 5 years after something that has happened to me, 5 years afterwards, I won't say that my behavior is because that particular thing happened to me. 5 years later, it looks like it's personality. In people, right? Or it looks like culture in it looks like personality in a person, and it looks like culture in a people, right? Time decontextualizes anger and hate and all those different types of things, and then it begins to look like culture and all of these different types of things. So that's why it's so hard, like when we talk about hate crimes and all that different type of stuff, we've developed all of these types of cognitive ways of kind of looking at this issue. And we never talk about how the body operates and how time can decontextualize these things. And so when you say, well, ask somebody, well, why would you blow up a church with four babies in it? Well, why would you go to Parkland into a high school and do these particular types of horrible things? Or why would you, you know, go into a Sikh temple and shoot up people that have no connection to you? Why would you do that? And if you only try and understand that from, you know, video games, or understand that from just the kind of tropes that we use, and not bring in the body and not bring in this kind of decontextualization of anger and trauma.
So help me understand that. Yes. So is the, when you're saying the body, are you talking about the person who's angry? They're dealing with stuff from that they've got from years ago. It's so they are, it's manifesting in a way that doesn't necessarily connect to what you're seeing in front of you.
And people may be dealing with this energy. Trauma and anger is about energy. It's like the way that I describe it is like a water hose, right? If you take a water hose and then tie a knot into it, and then and with no energy coming in through, you won't notice anything. But if you then go and turn the faucet on and that energy starts moving through, that pressure, right, up against the knot you start to feel that. And it isn't until you turn that down and allow the knot to unwrap that the energy can go through. So a lot of times we're carrying stuff within us that we have no articulation of because it's been passed down. It's intergenerational. It's historical. And so things get passed down and we don't even know where the energy is coming from. It looks like a family trait.
Mm. Mm-hmm. We're talking this hour about anger, how we manage it, where we see it, the fact that road rage incidents are on the rise, people are expressing their anger in social media and getting more comfortable being aggressive on social media. We'd love to hear from you. Do you or a loved one suffer from having hard times controlling your anger? What does that look like? Or how have you learned to manage it? Give us a call with your question or comment at 651-227-6000. At 651-227-6000, or you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. Yvette, are there different types of anger?
Well, I think of it a little bit more like different awarenesses we bring to the experience of anger and then different expressions that are culturally normative for different groups.
Mm-hmm.
Just building a little bit on what you were saying, Resma, that energy, we want to use that energy for a life-serving purpose.
Mm-hmm.
We want to harness the energy underneath anger because it gives us the motivation and the force we need to actually make changes, whether it's to protect ourselves, to protect others. So the degree to which we can take the anger that comes up when we're the energy that
mm-hmm.
comes up when we're angry,
that's right.
and channel it in a protective, mm-hmm. life-serving intention, mm-hmm. we want to be able to harness that. But what we're taught to do with anger is that either we're acting it out and we're getting aggressive, or we're numbing it out and we're repressing it, and then it's going to show up in all kinds of toxic, poisonous, sideways ways in relationships.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And so depending on cultural programming, on gender, on a lot of diversity, identity factors, there will be ways in which you will have been taught it's okay for you to express anger.
Mm. How does that, you know, it's interesting. I hear women anecdotally talk about how they'll be in a situation at work and they get really angry, but and they want to get angry, but
yeah.
instead they end up crying.
Yes.
And
yes.
where they felt like, you know, no, I need to be strong right now,
yes.
but why is this happening to me?
Yes.
Why am I crying? Is that
yes.
sort of because they've
that
been controlled?
That is sort of it.
Or?
Yes, well, because as a woman, I think I can relate to some of this. It's not
yeah.
really okay. You're bitchy if you're angry,
mm-hmm.
right? Or you're
mm-hmm.
bossy or you're all sorts of horrible things,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, we're so worried about how other people think of us that we then, you know, template ourselves. But it is a nervous system response. And so crying or laughing or getting aggressive are all ways of trying to discharge the energy, some more helpful, some less helpful. Go ahead.
Resma.
Anger is a particularly quick emotion.
Mm-hmm.
It is a fast, like, almost for some of the clients that I used to work with, it is not just an emotional piece, it is a sensory piece. So people don't just when people get angry, they don't just experience it in one domain. They don't just experience it cognitively. They experience it sensorily. They experience the image and thought. They experience meaning. They experience behavior. They experience vibrations and all that different type of stuff. And what begins to happen is that those things can be overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
And in that overwhelm, when people get too overwhelmed, one of the things that can happen, you can either fight something, you can flee something, or you can dissociate and freeze from it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times what we're seeing, and we live in a nation now where some of the words and some of the things that we that maybe even 6 years ago, right, you would never say to another person,
mm-hmm.
are now becoming so kind of mundane,
mm-hmm.
right? Just the small little disrespectful things that I could say to you and do it with anonymously online and do all of these different types of things to you and say these most horrible things to you is now becoming part of the kind of cultural interface that we have with each other. And so I think it is not the increase in hate crimes, the increase in road rage. I don't think you can look at in out of context of the trajectory of where America is right now, and not just America, but the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is why when me and Yvette were talking earlier, this is one of the reasons why we have to begin to think about what approaches that we're going to use, not just individually, mm-hmm. but as a community mm-hmm. to begin to heal this stuff.
Oh, interesting point. I want to get to that more in just a moment. I have a comment from Linda who writes, when I used to teach assertiveness classes at community education, I used to talk about a primary secondary view of anger, that anger is always the secondary emotion and that identifying the emotion you feel first, fear, sadness, whatever, is the key to managing the anger, which often quickly overwhelms the primary emotion. Mm-hmm. Does that make mm-hmm. sense to you, Yvette?
Yes, I it does make sense to me, and I have heard that way of framing it before. I think it can be a useful frame. I use a different frame.
Mm-hmm.
The frame that I use is that if I can focus only on the unmet need, if I can harness my attention onto the unmet need that is deeply, deeply important to me in this moment, whether it's safety, whether it's security, predictability, belonging, whatever the need is, if I can contain out all of the thinking of wrongness, because this pathologizing thinking that we do culturally is so unhelpful.
And that's the judging others.
The judging others. If I think there's something wrong with you, you become an enemy and I can do things to you. If I think there's something wrong with me, I become the enemy and I can start harming myself. So whether I think there's something wrong with you or something wrong with me, it's problematic. So if I can contain that thinking and begin working with that differently, and I can keep my attention on only the need, what I discover is that I'm probably feeling vulnerable, I'm feeling afraid, I'm feeling hurt, I have a variety of other things going on, other feelings that are feeding the unmet need and then driving the anger if I'm seeing it as threat. How do you see that? Do you...
So there, in reference to the question,
mm-hmm.
Yes, there is a primary and secondary mm-hmm. A kind of emotional state, but that's not the issue.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is that many times with regard to those emotional states, the speed and the texture of it are too fast and too overwhelming, so people begin to reflexively react.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have to do in terms of healing is to really help people slow down. Part of the work that I do is to help people slow it down so they can tolerate actually understanding what's underneath it. Most people can't tolerate understanding or getting a sense that, hey, the other thing that might be coupled with this might be my sense of support and security that I've never had.
Mm.
Not only have I never had it, my nervous system does not even know how to respond to resource. So when you're nice to me, the coupling is vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
And it drives people crazy because they think they're crazy. And what healing does is help people slow it down so they can begin to tolerate and build the stamina that they need in order to process it.
We're talking this hour about anger and where it comes from and how to manage it. You can call us with your question or comment at 651-227-6000. Let's go to the phones. We've got Logan on the line from Northern Minnesota. Logan, welcome to the conversation.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure,
I appreciate
thing.
It. So I've had an interesting thing happen in the last 3 months. Twice I've had it happen to me, and twice I've done it to other people. It deals with road rage.
Mm-hmm.
I live in a very rural area where we actually use our high beams, unlike people that live in the city. And when someone approaches you and they have their high beams on for what I deem to be too long of a period of time, and they're getting too close, we'll flash our high beams at them, trying to let them know, hey, you got your high beams on. Would you turn that down, please? And if they don't comply, I've gotten so angry, instantaneous reaction. I just get so angry that I leave my high beams on, and I've actually swerved towards them over the center line. Mm-hmm. And I've had it happen where they've been it to me. And
wow.
I'm just trying to understand I was just listening as I was on hold, and I was beginning to get an inkling of what I should do, which is slow it down. But
mm-hmm.
I just wanted to share that experience with everybody.
Thank you, Logan, for calling. I appreciate that. Yeah, how do you slow down your emotions and figure things out when you're driving 60, 70 miles an hour down the road?
Yeah. Sometimes, and Brother Logan, I want to thank you for that question because it's beautiful. This is the type of overwhelm that happens for people, and they start to begin to internalize and think that something's defective in them. Mm-hmm. Right. And this is what I said earlier. This can be a pass down. So one of the things is that when we get overwhelmed like that and we notice, like Brother Logan said, he's noticed that he wants to swerve and like hit the guy and then move back. He may not be able to do anything in that moment. But when he gets past that and he's still angry, if he can then slow down, that begins to teach the body backwards. Right. So he may not be able to do it then, but when he gets into a place where he has enough safety and enough distance, then he begins to slow down. Then he pulls off to the side. Then he sits and allows his body to discharge all by shaking, by crying, by laughing, by whatever it is that needs to be discharged. He allows it to happen. What we often do is when we have an experience like that, we just override it again. And then more of that energy, like the water hose, gets pushed right back up against that knot. And so then the next time it happens, it's that much more energy. So what I would say is he can slow it down. He may not be able to do it while he's going 70 miles an hour. But when he gets another mile down the road and he goes, what was that? Mm-hmm. Then he slows down. Then he pulls over.
Yvette, you were talking earlier about how anger is this combination of having these unmet needs and then the layers of judgment on top. Mm-hmm. How do you figure out what those unmet needs are that are the sort of the pool that's feeding into your anger?
Yeah. Well, what a lovely question, because it builds exactly on what I think Resma is talking about, which has to do with that, you know, we're going to make shifts in our issues with anger in hindsight and in foresight. We're not going to do it in crisis moments. Those are just the symptoms. That's not the place of intervention. The place of intervention is what I do afterwards and then what I do to prepare for the next time. So how do we develop an awareness of our needs is such a great question, because it's not culturally normative to have needs, to have a literacy of needs. You know, many of us, nonviolent communication is one of the ways that I think locally many people are developing a literacy of needs, because that's one of the foundational principles, knowing that there are things that unite us as human beings, and having a language for that, having a consciousness of it, beginning to have these kinds of wanderings, understanding in many ways that there's not that much wrong with us. Mm-hmm. We have inherited a lot of cultural strategies that do not work.
Mm. And if can you give me some examples?
Repressing our feelings. Mm-hmm. Not having ways of having feeling data be culturally normative in many of our workplaces, in many of the ways, in many of our public spaces. Privileging cognitive disembodied data as the primary way of knowing and the data that is most valued in objective science. Mm-hmm. And ignoring subjectivities. And not having a room for subjectivity, emotion, body-based data, working with things more holistically and integratively. I mean, I could go on forever, but
I get it.
I won't go on.
Well, we're talking this hour about anger, how it manifests, where it stems from, and how we can deal with it. Resma, James Baldwin once said, "I imagine one of the reasons people cling to their hates so stubbornly is because they sense once hate is gone, they'll be forced to deal with pain." And are talking about anger and hatred and the link there, it felt very relevant, this the idea that there is pain underneath that we're not dealing with.
Thank you for saying that quote. That's one of my favorite ancestors right there. And I always want to acknowledge my ancestors, also acknowledge the fact that our feet are on native ground, and what I mean by that is that hate is, we've been talking about it for a little while now with regard to hate being almost an individual piece, but hate can be institutionalized, right? There is a long history of this country in hate, right? This is not something new. And so I think that there is pain. There is when we talk about this country and institutions, there is an unhealed pain that has never been dealt with and acknowledged. And I think part of what you're seeing is an intergenerational transmission of that, an historical transmission of that. And until we begin, and that's why I say we have to do this as a community, until we begin to do that, it's going to be hard to get at it.
Mm-hmm. So. Yvette, when looking at sources of anger, and you have somebody who, say, is angry in the room with you, mm-hmm. how do you deal with them in the moment? Mm-hmm. Somebody who is manifesting more anger than you think is maybe normal or warranted by the mm-hmm. situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you first regulate your own nervous system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Right?
That's right.
You start with yourself. And you track your own capacity to stay present. And if you're in sort of your orange zone, then techniques are often a lot of mirroring, a lot of reflecting, a lot of joining with the energy, a lot of knowing that, if you know that you're safe enough, if you have physical danger, it can be a different thing.
Joining with the energy, does that mean like being as angry as they are in the
Mm-mm,
moment?
No. But you want to be in a zone that is enough of a match that they don't think you're being patronizing.
Mm-hmm.
You see, if you go too nice and too calmed down and I see you're very angry right now, then I'm really covering up my own anxiety and I'm not being authentic and it's going to come across condescending and patronizing.
That's right.
A lot of it is working with your own energy, with your own authenticity, joining in the zone where they feel like you're with them, mm-hmm. and then slowly walking them down if they're willing to follow, which they may or may not be.
Mm-hmm.
But you meet anger with a lot of empathy.
Mm-hmm.
You see the person. You see what they are going to bat for.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phone lines. We've got Ed on the line from Minneapolis. Ed, welcome to the conversation.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I myself have a little bit of an anger issue sometimes, and mm-hmm. I've recently come upon a solution that I've been using to improve myself, and I joined a league, and it seems to use a lot of my energy that I used to go towards anger, and now I respond to arguments and stuff in a very calm manner, but that's only because the excess energy that I had before is now used when I go play in that league.
And what kind of league are you playing in?
Now.
Oh, you play hockey?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yes.
Yeah, certainly you're getting
and
a lot of energy out there.
Yes, and it really helped me in the way that I live my life day to day. I don't have that excess energy, and it really helped me.
Yeah.
All right.
Just wanted to relay that comment.
That's beautiful.
Thanks. Appreciate that.
That's beautiful.
Resma?
What he's basically talking about is what me and Sister Yvette has been talking about, is that's metabolization. Mm-hmm. If when we have raw anger, even if many times we don't even know where it's coming from, we just have a sense of it. I don't know why I'm so angry, right? And they go to people and people try and deal with them cognitively and all that different type of stuff, and they still can't get at it. One of the things that an old mentor used to always say to me, she used to say when I was working with a client that was particularly angry and it would come out of nowhere, she would say, Resma, what do I always say? I always say that if something is hysterical, it is usually historical.
Hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
There's you have to ask where the other energy is coming from if it doesn't meet what you're dealing with at this particular time. And so what brother was just talking about was how he has begun to metabolize that energy. He may never know why he was so angry, but if he can learn to metabolize it and slow it down and move through, it creates enough room on his nervous system for other possibility that didn't exist before.
Tib wrote, as a native Minnesotan and a woman, my signature line has long been, I'm so angry I could implode.
Yeah.
The sense of that's a very Minnesotan,
yes.
And the sense that we don't like to express our anger.
Yeah.
Yvette, are there consequences culturally as a group if we don't express our anger?
Absolutely. It's going to get expressed. It's just going to come out sideways. So, I think it's a form of self-harm when we don't express our anger. And I also think it's a form of harming others if we become aggressive with our anger. So I think it's really important to separate out the thing we're going to bat for with the strategies we then use to express it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Margaret on the line in Minneapolis. Margaret, welcome to the conversation.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
So I just wanted to share my experience around child rearing and specifically parenting a highly spirited child, as they're sometimes called. I was myself a very spirited child, meaning that I expressed myself with very, very strong emotions. And a lot of times, like the way that my parents dealt with it was like, shut up, go to your room, calm down, get out of the way, get on a timeout, you know, something like that. Basically shut down the emotion. And now me, myself being a parent, I have a 5-year-old now, but especially like when he was like 2, 3 years old, I mean, I went through this horrible stage with him. He was biting and pulling hair and doing all sorts of things that I think, you know, in a traditional parenting mindset would have, or, you know, in the school environment would have been, oh, this is a bad kid. There's horrible things happening in that household. It was really because he had a lot of unmet needs that he couldn't verbalize. And so I discovered this parenting philosophy. It's called RIE, which stands for something, but I won't go into it.
Okay.
But it's the whole idea about it is, you know, around helping kids to acknowledge their emotions and like allowing emotional release. So instead, when it, you know, instead of having a timeout, you have a time in. So you actually spend that time to like connect with the child and help to identify, you know, you're feeling very frustrated. You know, you were really angry that I did that, and explaining to kids, even pre-verbal kids. And I just wanted to say, like, my 5-year-old is one of the most emotionally intelligent kids now as a result of me following that parenting philosophy from very early on. And I also have grown so much kind of emotionally myself in terms of me recognizing what I'm feeling, because so much of my parenting reactions were it's about me. It wasn't about my kid's behavior. It was about me and what it was triggering in me. And, you know, now I try really hard, instead of getting angry, to really just like take that time to connect, recognize how I'm feeling, give myself a break. And it's, you know, not always perfect, but,
Excellent.
I don't know. Somehow I feel that's really relevant to what you guys are talking about.
Absolutely, Margaret. Yes, thanks so much. Yes. Resma, you want to comment on that?
Yeah. She, once again, what did she say? She slowed it down, right? She slowed it down so she could begin to give her child and herself enough time to actually figure out what was coupled together and what was hooked together. So one of the things that I heard earlier that I want to just make a note of is that when we talk about Minnesota Nice, right, that silence in that capacity is cultural, right? That the idea of constricting and going silent and imploding, right, is a cultural manifestation. And so once again, this is why I keep coming back to this idea that we're going to have to figure out how we develop a culture around it. We can talk about anger, we can talk about rage, we can talk about trauma and all that different type of stuff. But if we don't figure out how to develop community ways of healing each other and healing with each other, it's going to be really hard to unhook some of the most salient pieces of anger and rage and all that stuff.
Yvette, if you're a woman, is your rage or your anger viewed differently?
I would say yes.
Can you give us an idea of how our emotions as women, how our anger is treated or viewed differently?
Yeah, I'm sure it's, you know, I don't want to speak for all women. What I can say for myself is that I find myself very inhibited around expressions of anger. I find that I need to slow down a lot more. I try to be nicer about it. I feel like I need to make myself palatable when I'm angry. I feel like I need to anticipate how the other person is going to react a lot more. And I don't know that all of the men in my life have that same. Maybe they do, but that does feel like a very female conditioning in me. I don't know. What do you think about that, Resma?
Well, from a black male perspective, there is real danger in expressing anger. I mean, there is a real possibility of murder. There is a real possibility of my people being institutionally damaged by my expression of anger. I can't be angry by myself without that being a reflection on my people. The white body and white people don't have that same type of kind of peace, right? It's not this collective identity that has been heaped on the white body. And I think that this idea of anger or having the full range of emotion, right? Whether it be angry, happy, sad, whatever it is,
can't be to anything.
That's not available to me in the ways that, you know, I always go back to the white body in this country is the supreme standard by which all other bodies' humanity shall be measured. And so I am deviant. My body is deviated from that standard. And so I don't have the same breadth of human experience that maybe that the larger society has.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Chersti in Minnetonka. Chersti, welcome to the conversation.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good. Hey, my comment is that anger, what I've observed is that anger seems to be habitual, and that the more you do it and respond to things angrily, the easier it is to have just a total knee-jerk reaction to almost anything out of anger and rage. And I'm wondering if that's something to do with adrenaline, or if it's kind of a wiring of the brain that happens over time. The more you do it, the more it feels right?
Good question. Thanks. Mm-hmm. Yvette?
I think of it as wiring of the brain. The things that we do habitually, the things that we do over and over become like a high road in our reactivity. And so as we repeat it, those neurons get, they fire together, as Rick Hansen often says. And so they do become habituated and they do become the go-to reaction. Yeah.
It's a wiring of the brain and the body.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
it's not just the brain or the cognitive pieces. The body begins to react. And remember what I said earlier, that it is about protection. And so over time, if I do it long enough, if somebody says to me, "Hey, you should try something else," that actually feels vulnerable to me. Mm-hmm. That actually feels, or I experience it as, I'm not the problem, right? Mm-hmm. And so the more you practice it, the more it becomes, the more it works, right? Anger works. It doesn't work to deepen my relationship with you, but it does work.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Matt on the line in Minneapolis. Matt, welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I just wanted to chime in. I think Yvette mentioned that there's a lot of ways in which maybe we don't have adequate cultural resources just kind of in Western culture in general to healthily deal with anger or to understand it. And I agree with that. But I also wanted to throw in, I think a large part of that is maybe just a misinterpretation of some of the texts and some of the resources that we do have. And from a Christian perspective, I think one thing that I think about a lot is in the Bible where Jesus says, "Judge not." I went through a situation where there was a very deep hurt that was caused by another person to me. And for me, going back and looking at that, and instead of just saying, kind of skimming over the words or maybe going to some of the behaviors that our Western culture has encouraged, kind of thinking about what that actually means, judge not. And I kind of realized that it meant maybe I don't actually even know why I'm actually angry. Maybe this isn't even about this other person. I mean, it seems to be caused by this other person, but maybe there's something underneath the surface. And I just think that first step of like stepping back and admitting that I don't have the full understanding.
Yeah, like what Resmaa was saying about slowing down.
Yeah, it's slowing down, but I just, and the more I've been looking at the Bible and other Western, or not Western, but just, predominant cultural narratives that we have, I do think there's a lot of richness, a lot of texture to the traditions that we did grow up with, but we just aren't aware of them because maybe they've been misinterpreted or we haven't paid attention to them.
Thanks so much for that. I appreciate it. The idea of forgiveness, how does forgiving help your own anger, even? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Does that?
I would start with understanding. Mm-hmm. I think what Matt is bringing in is this very powerful point of when we can suspend our judgment, when we don't get stuck in what is wrong, and we instead begin asking about what Resmaa's bringing in. What is the pain? What is the unhealed pain? And what are the tragic unconscious strategies that many of us keep enacting? We can find a much wider range of more effective long-term choices.
Mm-hmm. We have time for just one more caller. Let's go to Aaron in Mankato. Aaron, welcome.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to touch on the historical trauma and the anger that, and maybe as a society and as a culture, we can start with the Native Americans here that are a product of genocide and how growing up you're angry, you don't really know, you become more educated. It's not something your parents want to bring up to you. And just my experience of dealing with the years of anger that I had and, the outlets I had, speak up, exercise, and then the pain. that was associated with that. And I think as a society, we could start there and acknowledge that and bring that more into the forefront. Because
yes.
Native American populations were less than 1%, and we were here, you know.
That's right.
Yeah. Aaron, thank you so much for sharing that. I really appreciate your call. You know, this is almost unfair to bring this up with only 5 minutes left in the program, but, you know, I recently interviewed a Washington Post correspondent, Philip Bump, about mass shootings in the United States and asked if there was a typical profile for these shooters. Here's his response.
They're white men. Not exclusively, obviously. They're not exclusively white. They're not exclusively men, but they're overwhelmingly white and they're overwhelmingly men. Obviously, school shootings tend to be younger because it is generally school students that are doing the shootings, but that's not necessarily the case for all of these shooting incidents. The age range is wider than that, but that is, if you're looking for a profile, that's the profile in short.
Any ideas on why we see more violent displays of rage in white men?
That is true for, I think, maybe recently.
Mm-hmm.
But my people have had an experience with white men for a very long time and white women for a very long time that has been rageful for no reason. I mean, not that we earned it, but African-American people did not earn the amount of rage that was heaped upon our bodies. Right. Native American people didn't earn the amount of rage that was heaped upon our bodies. And so I think that what we're starting to see now is that people are seeing it in larger communities. But if you go to communities in the South and communities where you had primarily black or native people, that we know what that rage is like for apparently no reason. And so, you know, I just think that, you know, something that Aaron said a little while ago is that some of this stuff is so unspoken and we turn it in on ourselves as Native American people, as African American people, as people of color. We turn that stuff in on ourselves when it's the historical pieces. We can readily get at the personal pieces, right? This happened to me, that happened to me. But those historical pieces can elicit rage also because we can't articulate it. It's been passed down for so long, we can't articulate.
Yvette, what would be going on then in those white people's minds and bodies that's, you know, creating that rage that's being dumped on other people?
Yeah. I think what we're seeing is what makes it makes a lot of sense when white people generally have been in positions of superiority. There's an entitlement. I get to be violent. I am the norm. I get to have power over other people.
It is the standard.
It is the standard, so I'm not surprised. And we do need to start giving people access to a much wider range of choices and strategies for talking about what it is that's really going on underneath that.
We have just a couple of minutes left. Any ideas on how that should happen?
In community with others.
Yes.
Is this about empathy building?
Yes, it's also about giving people a language. You know, the caller who called in with her son, when we can begin naming feelings, naming the body sensations, getting aware of our images, getting aware and doing it in a non-pathologizing way, we'll start making strides.
Yeah.
Rasma?
And developing it in the context of community.
Mm-hmm.
So people begin to understand the nuance of language, the nuance of racial stamina, the nuance of humility, right?
Thank you so much, both of you. This has been a fascinating hour. We could easily talk for another hour on this topic, but thanks so much to both of you. We've been talking with Yvette Erasmus, who's a psychologist, consultant, and leadership coach with expertise in nonviolent communication, and with Rasma Menakem. He's worked with multiple communities on equity and race. He's currently a consultant and has a private therapy practice in Minneapolis. He's the author of My Grandmother's Hands, Racialized Trauma, and the Pathway to Mending Our Hearts and Bodies. Do stay tuned. Check in with us tomorrow at 11. I'll be talking with poet and essayist Kevin Young about his new book, Bunk.
It's a book about hoaxes and con artists and what they tell us about ourselves, particularly as Americans. It's published by Minneapolis-based Gray Wolf Press. That's tomorrow at 11. And then on Thursday, U.S. Senator Tina Smith will join NPR's Mike Mulcahy to talk about issues facing Congress and take your calls. Smith replaced Al Franken after he resigned in the wake of sexual misconduct allegations. She's settling into her job as Minnesota's junior senator and preparing to run in November to keep her seat. Tune in and call in Thursday at 11 for that.